Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Wherever you are, this is the Interpreter's Workshop Podcast. I'm Tim Curry, your host. Here we talk everything sign language interpreting. The ins, the outs, the ups, the downs, the sideways of interpreting. If you're a student, a new interpreter, experienced interpreter, this is the place for you. If you want to know more, go to interpretersworkshop.com. Let's start talking interpreting. And now, the quote of the day by Dr. Seuss. Sometimes you may never know the value of a moment until it becomes a memory. This is part one of an interview that I had with a great colleague, a wonderful interpreter with a good heart. Let's learn more about the interpreting profession in Scotland and hear some valuable moments in the life of Bruce Cameron. Bruce, it's really good to see you.
Thank you.
We've known each other a long time, about 14 years now.
I was trying to work this out this morning, actually. I think it's
2009.
Yeah, conference.
You sure?
Because I moved from Aberdeen down to Glasgow in 2009 in April, and I think this was September 2009.
Yeah.
So that would be,
not quite 13.
Almost.
Yeah. Wow. And we're still friends. It's weird. It's nice because our friendship kind of grew as the profession has been growing, right?
Absolutely.
And the interpreting profession, for those of you listening. And if you're listening and you don't know the interpreting profession, then thanks a lot. That's really strange. But anyway, so obviously you're from Scotland.
Yes.
Say Aberdeen and Glasgow.
Aberdeen and Glasgow. Yep.
I know a little bit about your early life,
but
I know that you had a lot of different jobs before you became a professional interpreter. Can you tell us some of the things that you actually did?
For me, growing up as a kid, obviously...
As a kid, not as an adult. Okay.
Not as an adult, yeah. Growing up as a kid.
Yeah, okay.
I was, I suppose, a coder, which for those who are listening, who aren't interpreters and don't know, it's a child of a deaf adult. And the thing is, I never labeled myself as a coder, and I didn't really know what that word meant until I moved down to start interpreting. It was never a thing. It was never part of me. I just had deaf parents, and that was it. And that, you know, I never, that label didn't exist for me. So because my parents were deaf and university wasn't a thing in the family, I went straight into work. And my first job from school, I left school halfway through what would have been the last year. So I would have been roughly about 17, just before my 18th birthday. I was working for a printing company and it was estimating role. So it was basically working out the costs of how to print magazines and newsletters, all this different sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And I worked in the printing trade for years, actually, and then discovered DJing late in life. Most DJs start when they're about 17, 18. I was, I think, nearly 30, discovered music late. Obviously, mum and dad, when they brought records home from you know, work, it would have been, I think, the Avalanches or the Tornadoes or some obscure 60s bands, because they got their records from a second-hand shop. But they didn't know what they were buying. They didn't. They've never heard of stuff. They just picked up records, thought, "Oh, this will do." So the kids will like it.
So they bought that for you and your siblings.
Yeah. My sister and I. Yes. And we got access to all the sort of music growing up. But so I fell into DJing for a while and did that for about 10 years. And then one of my other part-time jobs was I was the club mascot for the local football team. And I used to get paid for running about dressed as a, I was going to say a cow, but it's a bull. It's for Aberdeen Football Club. If you Google Aberdeen Football Club Angus the Bull, you'll see a picture of me. I've had a few different type jobs. The DJing was part time, and then I became full time running the agency. So we used to organise DJs and music for corporate events, weddings, birthday parties, that sort of stuff. And that job itself isn't for you know, it's a simple job for somebody younger and fitter. There was a lot of work at weekends.
Yeah,
so that didn't suit at all. And then I went back into working for another small printing company. I then decided it was something that came up. It kind of piqued my interest with regards to interpreting. And it was something I'd never thought of before. I remember at the age of 17, before my first job, my mum had said to me, "You should become an interpreter." And the only route back then, that would have been 1990. The only route for me back then was to go to Durham University to do, I think it was a four-year course at that time. There was no, there's different routes here, but that was the only route at the time. And I couldn't...
Four-year course. Okay.
back then. And I couldn't fathom being away from my friends and family, because university was never a thing for our family. You know, yeah. It was interesting because at that time, my aunt, who I was very close to, worked away in Dundee, but she wasn't there to explain to me that living away is fine. So I had that kind of fear of moving away from my hometown, my friends, and you know, I just couldn't grasp at that point. Now it's completely different, however. And at the same time, a 17-year-old going into interpret, a 17, 18-year-old going into interpreting, looking at it now, it's far too early. And I realized that at the time, you know, my life experience consisted of watching American football and eating pizza. You know, that was my life experience. And thinking after 4 years, what experience have I got to interpret for people? Yeah. I don't. So they left it. And then, when was it? 2008. It was 2008. The Scottish government decided they were going to have a pilot plan for trainee interpreters. They were going to take a cohort of 10 interpreters, or 10 people who could sign, and put them through a short 18-month pilot, which was both workplace and university-led. So you had a blend of the two. So you were placed within a deaf organisation or interpreting organisation, and then you had courses delivered by the University of Leeds once a month for 18 months. And then at the end of that, you became a fully qualified interpreter, which I think worked. It certainly worked for me. I think it worked for the others in the cohort. However, some other interpreters thought that, these are the classes, the microwave or the pot noodle, interpreters. Because it was, they've had to do their 4 years or 5 years or whatever, and we've come in and out less than 2 years.
Yeah. So why did they have that program then? If you had 4 year programs, why set this up?
Because the 4 year program wasn't in Scotland. That was done in England.
Oh, I see.
So in Scotland, they wanted to boost the number of interpreters fairly quickly. And to get 10, it ended up 11 of us, and to get us all done fairly quickly, immersed in the culture, because of the 10 of us, 3 of us were CODAs, and 7, I think there was an 11th one that came along later on, 7 and 8 of them weren't. So what you had was people who had learned sign language up to a certain level. They didn't have that cultural interactions. By putting them into organizations that were dealing with deaf people day in, day out, they would get that. Don't get me wrong, everybody came in, bar one, but I would say 99% of everybody came in are still interpreting today, and in my opinion, very, very good interpreters. Excellent interpreters.
So these others had learned the language through courses or something beforehand?
Yes.
Okay, I see.
So what happened, you were assessed initially at a specific level, so it would have been level 3. That was the assessment. Mm-hmm. Now, everybody else, I think, bar but one other, had the level 3 qualification. I and another didn't, because I had no need to actually go to a course. Yeah. So I was assessed, and the assessment was fine. And then we got on through that.
Yeah.
It was interesting, actually, because I remember going and giving a list of all the names of everybody that was on the course. Now, I didn't know any of the names, but what you got was a name and their qualification next to them. So you had a name with somebody who has got a diploma in another language, or they had a diploma in a master's in something. I didn't have that because I never went to university. I went straight from school to work.
But
what I did have after my name was Bruce is a CODA, right? Now, I felt, how did I feel? I felt a bit, not intimidated is probably the wrong word. I felt a little bit inadequate, I suppose, because I'm in a room with people who are academics. A lot of them have been to university and I hadn't been.
What was the age range?
Early to mid 20s to late 30s, early 40s.
Yeah.
You know, so that was your range.
Yeah. So people that weren't inexperienced as adults.
No.
Okay.
And what was interesting, what came out of it, we had a conversation, was that my fear of the group being academic as such, and for me not having been to university, was unfounded because they were feeling the opposite. Because they'd been to university, I was a coder. And in that field, they thought that I would be looking down on them because I have had 30 odd years of sign experience, which wasn't the case. We were all in the same boat.
Yeah. I kind of had that same feeling when I first started. I was, this is my second career, as you know, and I was in my 30s. I'm counting. Yes, 30s. So how did you guys get on? How did you communicate as a cohesive group, or were you feeling like individuals? Or
no, it was really interesting actually, because I think because we met up once a month for a weekend.
Okay,
it was a weekend, a weekend once a month.
And I see.
We'd come out and people were paired off into their own agencies or their own companies that they're being kind of hosted in. So I had another person who there's two of us in our place, so we would bounce with each other. We got on well, but then when we got back as a group, it was like, oh, it was nice to see everybody back, because we had a month between, this is our experience, and you wanted to share and talk to everybody. Yeah, so I thought the group was quite nice. We, even to date, I still keep in contact with a few of them, not all of them. I think some have left the industry for one reason or another, but not for anything bad. But you know, we got on really well, and there was absolutely no, I think the cohesion came in very, very quickly.
Yeah. Do you feel like because you went through only an 18-month program, do you feel like you missed something that you would have gotten from a 4-year program, or no?
No, because firstly, I don't know what I would have missed.
True. Yeah.
So I don't know what I would have missed. However, what I did gain is the experience of day to day. Now, for me, luckily, I was based in a deaf communication service, which housed a deaf club as well. Right. So we had deaf people and deaf staff, and that on a daily basis, I don't think you money can't buy. Yeah. And that was, for me, was an absolute bonus. Now, saying that, I've been around deaf people from birth. However, being around deaf people who aren't your parents on a daily basis is something you can't, you know, it's fantastic.
That's what I was going to ask you. Because you're CODA, why would that be a fantastic experience when you've been around deaf all your life? How did you see them as different? Or how did this experience feel differently than in your family environment and friends who are deaf?
It was different because people were work colleagues. So you had respect for your work colleagues and not... Mm-hmm. Not giving your mum and dad disrespect because you're a teenager, you know. So there was that. Your friends that you'd go out in the pub now, and there'd be deaf people there that you knew, and you'd speak to them. And I never experienced that at home. You know, that's not.
Yeah.
It was just nice, and the range of language. Being in Glasgow now. Being in Glasgow, you have. And I come from Aberdeen, so for those who don't know, Aberdeen's on the east coast of the northeast coast of Scotland. Glasgow's on the west coast, and there's only 150 miles between them, so it's not far. Two and a half hours drive, and there are obviously regional variations in sign language.
I hope you're enjoying this as much as I am. If you have any ideas for the podcast, contact me at interpretersworkshop.com. For now, let's go back.
And there are two variations in Glasgow depending on which religion you are. So you're moving down, and that's fine. And then I'm now learning different signs for different things based on different religions. And I would have never got that at home at all.
Yeah.
Because you're shielded, and even up in Aberdeen, it's not that far. I used to go home and my mum would say, "Would you stop signing Glaswegian?" Because I picked up dialect, you pick up things.
Uh-huh.
So there's two different sign languages in Glasgow because of depending on the religion, depending on which school you went to. It was fascinating. So for me, this was all brand new, and finally got to learn swear words in sign language because my mum and dad wouldn't teach me. You know. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the daily mix of interacting with people I didn't know, but got to know.
So when you transitioned to, quote, professional interpreter, did you look back and see that, oh, I was interpreting for my parents, or did you ever do that? did you have that part of your life experience?
That was my life experience. Yeah, I was an interpreter. I was that conduit for my mum. My dad, he just took out his pen and bit of paper, and he would just write notes to whoever he needed to. Dad grew up in a hearing environment. Both parents hearing. His dad was away at sea quite a lot. His sister's hearing. He lived in a street with all hearing people, but he went to the deaf school, but wasn't residential. So we'd come home and play with friends in the street we're hearing. So he got used to being around hearing people. Mum, however, she was residential. So she came down and was immersed in deaf culture, you know, from 5 through till 16. So that's where the differences are with my parents. And it was Mum that would lean on me to interpret for her, you know, go to the doctors, phone the bank, in shops. And it's looking back, actually, it's really bizarre because I completely blocked it out until you asked the question. And she used to take me, she used to go into town on a Saturday into the shops, you know, as mums do. But yeah. I would go with her. As a teenage boy, I'm looking back here. Yeah. Why would a teenage boy want to go with his mum shopping? Yeah. I don't know why I did it, but part of me was, and I remember sometimes I'd be a little bit embarrassed about signing in public. You know, as a teenage boy, you're going through the, you know, you're going through the change and all that sort of stuff, and you know, people are looking at you because you're waving your hands about. You know, and you think, why are they waving your hands about? And I'll be honest, I did get embarrassed, and I think there was a period of my life where I kind of wanted to dip out of the deaf community because I was going through that change, becoming from a high pitched boy into a more of a deeper voiced man, and I didn't want attention. I didn't want people to look and think, yeah, it was strange. But yeah, mum has always used me up until recently, actually, where she's now kind of started leaning on my sister. Because my sister's local. I would come home to faxes and, you know, there'd be a fax sitting there saying, Bruce, can you phone the garage? My car, you know, yes, okay. And,
fax. You had your own inbox at home. Absolutely. That you had to come in and check that every time you came in. And wow.
I was showing my age here, but it was a roll of thermal paper. And it would, would be about like 6 feet.
I mean, I don't know what that is.
Uh-huh. It was about 6 feet long. So this big,
oh my gosh.
Like 10 faxes, one after the other. And sitting on the floor, and you'd look, right, okay, first one, phone the garage. Second one, right, I need to phone this one. Next one, I've got a letter. What does this letter mean? Right, okay. And that, for me, was the norm.
Yeah.
That was the norm, and, you know, that's who I am.
Does it feel strange now that you're away from your well, obviously, living away and not part of that anymore? Or does that feel natural as well?
It feels absolutely natural. It feels absolutely natural. Okay. It's Mum and Dad are quite good, actually. Dad's, he keeps himself to himself, but Mum will send me the odd text or email saying, and it's usually a phishing email, and it'll say, what does this mean? And I'll reply back saying, just ignore it, delete, thank you. And that's it. That's the scope of it now, you know. And it's absolutely fine. And, you know, I've got other dependencies as in the kids, but yeah, the parents, they're less dependent. And I think that's because my sister goes and visits on a daily. No, mum's in her 70s, you know, so she doesn't have to phone the bank. She doesn't have to do this now, you know. So there's less for her to worry over. So she's absolutely fine. And I think with technology as well, technology has really opened up independence for them.
Even at their age, they're
comfortable
with it.
Mum made a big thing about wanting to know all about tech. And when I was 10, so this would be 1983, they bought a first computer back in 83.
Nice.
The Commodore 64.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And, yeah. I mean, I'll have to Google that later. I don't know what you're talking about, but go on.
I think there's a slight age difference here. But what was interesting was mum was the first person to get a Minicom. I think it was the old text phones. It was a keyboard. Two rubber cups.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And you put the headset on it and then type and so forth.
Yeah.
Yeah, we call that the TTY,
the TTY
in the US.
I think they're called Minicoms, they were called here. And we got them in our old house, which would have been prior to me being 10. So in the early 80s, we had them. And mum was comfortable with using, and she used them for, and then she moved on to fax, and then she moved on. So she's always been kind of up to date with stuff.
Sure.
The only thing that she struggles with is the emails that look quite official, as in the phishing ones.
Yes.
And that's not just a death problem.
No. You know, I have trouble with that sometimes. You're in a hurry and you're like, wait, what? PayPal wants me to do. No, I don't need that.
Yeah. So they're quite good with that.
Okay. Well, I think I've fished enough into your personal life. Let's move the conversation to questions that we have out in the audience and myself. Every country is different when it comes to interpreting, as far as how they're paid or how much they're paid, who orders the interpreter, because institutional systems are different in every country, right? So in Scotland, how do you get jobs as an interpreter, and how are you paid, and who decides what that pay is?
Sure. In Scotland, we're actually very, very lucky in the sense that the British Sign Language was made and it was recognised as an official legal language back in 2015. So there is a responsibility on public bodies, let's say hospitals, the NHS, to provide interpreters. There's a legal requirement now. So what we've seen is there's been a slight growth in interpreting agencies. There, I would say in Scotland, there's one, two, three main ones. Two big ones. There's a charity and there's a private company. I think there's only one main charity that provides interpretation services, and the rest are private companies. So they are the ones that will get a lot of the work. Now, that's not to say that we don't get work direct through word of mouth, and we will get contacted by deaf people saying, just to book us direct. And those deaf people who book direct will use and will have a fund from the UK government called Access to Work. So what they do is they apply for Access to Work. Now, Access to Work is a fund that not just deaf people, but anybody with a disability can access, and they will fund stuff. You know, so for example, they would, for deaf people, it's interpretation. So they would come up and say, how many hours do you need a week of interpreters? And they will then fund them for that. And I think there's a maximum of something, I think it's about 30 hours a week. They will fund interpreters for 30 hours for a year. It's usually a 3-year period.
They pay them monthly, deaf person, I mean.
No, they don't. What you do is, so I would send my invoice to the deaf person. The deaf person then fills out the form and then posts that form off to the DWP, so the Department of Work and Pensions, and we get paid direct by them.
I see. Okay.
There was a pilot where they paid the funds to the deaf person and the deaf person then paid us. But that was an option. If the deaf person felt comfortable with it, they were more than happy to do it. I don't know if it still happens, but everybody that I work with, I send them an invoice. They then put all their invoices together, post it off, then we get paid direct. By.
If that person doesn't do that amount of work, then you're not paid.
No, how do you mean?
So there's three different ways you're talking about getting paid or getting jobs. One from the agencies, I guess you're registered with them.
Yes.
And then they order you and then they pay you.
Absolutely.
From funding that they get somehow from the government.
Or from, if it's from a private company.
Okay, sure. Then that. It does. Okay. Yep. And then you have Access to Work, which is funded directly from the government organization, Department of Work, that sort of thing. Yep. And then another one where they are paying you directly that the deaf person has to fill out paperwork for.
So, So just go back. I think maybe confuse that slightly. I think I confuse that slightly. So
no, that's okay.
So what you have is agencies who will get bookings from whoever. So private companies, other charities, you know, disability access forums, that sort of stuff. So they'll book us. We'll register with them. They'll book us. We'll do the job, then they pay us. Right, so that's one. The next one is a deaf person contacts us direct. They get funding through Access to Work. For that instance, we invoice the deaf person. Deaf person fills out the paperwork. Attaches your invoice, sends it off to the Department of Work and Pensions, and then you get paid sometime. Now, that sometime could be 6 weeks. It could be 6 months. You know, it's there is a thing on the go just now, and I'm sure that some listeners, if you are in the UK, you're listening, there are variations of when people get paid. You know, it's a bit horrendous for some people.
Yeah. And that's connected to the access to work program,
yes,
you mean?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I see.
And I think most of the agencies will pay and pay up in time.
Yeah.
No issue. No issue at all. And then there are private people who will contact you direct. So private companies will say, we need an interpreter for an event that we're hosting. And you just invoice them direct and they'll pay you.
Thank you so much for listening all the way to here. Let me take two points out of this episode to connect these points together in a way that will help not only CODA interpreters, but non-CODA interpreters. The first point is, being a CODA for Bruce didn't mean anything special, didn't mean that he was an inspirational aspect for others to take into their lives. For him, it was just normal life. And he didn't think of himself as an interpreter until later in life, even though he was interpreting for his family throughout his life. It was just normal. So when he started the course, he initially had that reaction that most of us have, that feeling of inadequacy, something about his skills or his knowledge that he was lacking, and he was comparing himself to others. In fact, then he realized that everybody in the room was feeling the same way, but for different reasons. And I think we can take that experience into our own work as an interpreter to realize we should not be comparing ourselves to others. Just because he was CODA did not mean he knew the language or the culture more than us, at least to a way that negatively impacted those non-CODAs. Because even he felt the benefits of being immersed in a group of deaf workers and colleagues every day in that course. For those regions and countries out there that also have a high demand for more interpreters, this pilot program is a nice way to blend academics with the immersion of culture and language in the workplace. It's a nice way to blend work, language, and cultural understanding with a time to discuss and share what that means academically and within the interpreting community. It gives you that foundation to understand that we are working with people as a person, not as machines of interpretation. We're all in the same boat, as Bruce says. CODAs, non-CODAs, we're all working together and learning from each other. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I look forward to the next episode where you will learn a little more detail about the interpreting profession in Scotland and a little bit more about how Bruce, from his experiences, approaches decision-making as an interpreter. See you next time.